Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 309 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about breast cancer and the USMLEs. If you know this podcast, you'll pretty much be able to get every breast cancer question you see right from your exam. And again, for those of you that are studying for Step 2CK Step 3, I have a course, actually two courses next week. The first one is an MBME Test Taking Strategist course. It's on Tuesday next week from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We'll basically work on test taking strategies. And I'm not just going to be teaching you strategies. I'm going to be using actual questions to go over those strategies, right? So you become very good at taking MBME exams. And then the 20-hour Step 2CK Step 3 course will be from Wednesday to Saturday, right? It's from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 5 hours every day. And basically, we'll be covering peds, surgery, IM, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, biostats, ethics, those November 2020 changes. And also, I'll be focusing on a lot of pathophysiology from Step 1 that they've incorporated into the new Step 2CK exams and Step 3 exams. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I'll give you information on cost and every other thing you may need. Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right? So breast cancer, right? So breast cancer is, is bad, right? And unfortunately, it's probably like the most frequently diagnosed cancer in women, right? Although remember, skin cancers are more popular, but, you know, typically on exams, we're going to go more with breast cancer here, right? Breast cancer. And the thing is, breast cancer, of all the malignancies that afflict women, right, it's like the second most common cause of cancer death, right? Remember, lung cancer is kind of number one. Lung cancer is bad, right? I mean, like many people, if you get lung cancer, chances are you're going to die. If you get breast cancer, chances are you may die, but there's also pretty good chances you may survive. I mean, we have a lot of really good therapies for this stuff right now, right? So what is the biggest risk factor? So, and I'll try as much as possible to use like scenarios on this, because the thing is, most times breast cancer questions on MBME exams, they show up as scenario questions that kind of messes people up, right? So they are like me, all these decision trees. I feel like OB-GYN as a discipline is a decision tree specialty, right? It's great for people that love decision trees, right? So what is the biggest risk factor for breast cancer? Well, the biggest risk factor for breast cancer is actually age, right? The older a person is, the woman is, the higher the likelihood of her having breast cancer, right? But there are some other risk factors that your friends at the MBME may put where they would not put age, right? So say, for example, if a person has a family history of breast cancer, that can increase their risk of getting breast cancer, especially like in a first degree relative, right? So they can be mean on a test and put like, oh, history of breast cancer in a second degree relative. If you see that, that is not so much of a risk factor. It's being a first degree relative that increases a person's risk of having breast cancer, right? And then one other thing they can also do, they may say in the QSTEM that, oh, this person in the past has had like a mammogram with biopsy, like a corneal biopsy that showed like lobular hyperplasia or like atypical ductal hyperplasia. And then in the QSTEM, they can also put that, oh, the person is like 65 years old. And they will say, oh, what is the biggest risk factor for breast cancer in this patient? And then they'll put age as an answer, and they'll put like atypical ductal hyperplasia as an answer. If you see that as an answer choice, go with atypical ductal hyperplasia. And then maybe like, Divine, what are you talking about, dude? You literally just said that age is the biggest risk factor for breast cancer. Yes, I know exactly what I said, right? But the thing is, if a person has biopsy-proven pre-malignant disease, of course, that's going to be a much higher risk factor, right, in that patient compared with age. Just something to keep in mind for exams, right? And remember, there are certain breast cancers that are driven by estrogen and progestin, right? So if for some reason you've had like abnormally large exposures to estrogen in your life, that's going to increase your risk of having breast cancer, right? Like, so for example, if a person has like early menarche, so you start having your period early, right? You're going to be experiencing more follicular phases in your life than the average person, right? So that's going to increase your risk of breast cancer. If a person has late menopause, right? So again, if you have late menopause, let's say you're going into menopause at 60, right? You've had more menstrual cycles than the average woman, right? So that's going to increase your risk of breast cancer, right? Because again, you've had more follicular phases. The more follicular phases you have, the more lifetime estrogen exposure you have, right? And also, if you're nulliparous, right? Again, if you're nulliparous, because remember, whenever you're pregnant, right? And also for about, you know, like roughly 6 months or so after you've delivered the baby, you're not going to be having periods, right? Because you're in a high prolactin state. Those high prolactin states essentially shut down the HPG access, right? So the thing that would happen is, if you're nulliparous, that means you're spending most of your life having menstrual cycles. Again, more follicular phases in the menstrual cycle, more estrogen exposure, more risk of breast cancer, right? And then also if you're obese, remember, people that are fat, remember, adipose cells contain an enzyme called aromatase, right? And aromatase, its job literally is to convert androgen to estrogen, right? So if a person is fat, right, they will have a ton of aromatase activity. They'll form a ton of estrogen. That will increase their risk of having breast cancer, right? Now, obviously, if a person has breast cancer, right, you know, there are some genetic things that can cause, that can increase a person's risk of breast cancer, right? So what are those things? Well, typically, is, you know, we're thinking about like BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. And, you know, for those of you that are taking the step one exam and you're like, oh, Divine, what is some basic science detail they can test with these BRCA mutations? I want you to think about DNA repair, right? Those things are associated with DNA repair, right? So if you have those mutations, you're going to have abnormal DNA repair. That's going to predispose the person to getting breast cancer, right? And the thing is, on MDM exams, they kind of want you to know some things that are associated with these BRCA mutations, right? So if, for example, they tell you that you see a person that is, they tell you that, oh, they've had like many family members that have gotten like a diagnosis of breast cancer before the age of 50, right? That's definitely something associated with a BRCA mutation, right? Or if you see like a history of like bilateral breast cancer, so they've had breast cancer in the right breast, in the left breast, that's going to increase, that's likely a person that has some kind of BRCA mutation, right? Or if you see a person that has a family history of breast and ovarian cancer, they have like both of those cancers together, think about a BRCA mutation, right? Or you see male breast cancer. Many people think that, oh, it's only women that get breast cancer. That's not true. Men, about 2,000 men roughly every year get breast cancer, right? Because men literally have breast tissue, right? So, and remember that breast cancer risk is actually increased in people that have Klinefelter syndrome, right? I just thought I should maybe go ahead and throw that out there, right? So, if you see male breast cancer in a family, right, that, again, those people probably have some BRCA mutation thing going. If a person is also like Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, right, that's something that's associated with an increased risk of BRCA mutations, right? And again, if you see just many, many people in the family getting breast cancer, you know, chances are there's probably some BRCA mutation thing going on, right? And typically, if a person is high risk for breast cancer like this, right? Like if a person has like these high risk factors, you know, it may not be the worst thing in the world to maybe get that BRCA genetic testing, right? Because the thing is, if a person has the BRCA gene mutations, it's actually kind of high yield to know some things, especially with screening. Because we know that for breast cancer, you know, the screening guidelines say, USPSTF says, start at 50, do it every 2 years, right? American Cancer Society says, start at 40, do it every year, right? And, you know, USPSTF says, you know, let's kind of cut things off at 75. But I will just tell you this, for purposes of MBM exams, it's not a problem to start screening people at the age of 40. The MBME, they have, I will say in general, they tend to lean more with the American Cancer Society recommendations than the USPSTF recommendations in that regard, right? So that's something to keep in mind. So we know the guidelines for normal people, but what are the guidelines for people that have BRCA mutations? People that have BRCA mutations, right? Those people need annual mammograms and breast MRIs. So you need to do a mammogram, but you can't just do a mammogram. Those are the, basically, if you see a breast MRI question on your exam, it's going to be these people, right? People with BRCA mutations, right? And the thing is, usually people with BRCA mutations, one thing that's routinely recommended for them on MBM exams is they can say, oh, how can you treat or reduce their risk of developing future malignancy? Well, you just do prophylactic surgery, right? So basically, what's the prophylactic surgery you do for these folks? Well, the thing you're usually going to do is you're going to do a bilateral mastectomy, right? So you're going to take out both of their breasts. But then in addition to that, usually these people are also candidates for a THBSO, right? THBSO. Well, what in the world do I mean by THBSO? By THBSO, I mean total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, right? So you're basically cutting out the woman's ovaries, cutting out the fallopian tubes, cutting out the uterus as well, right? In addition to the bilateral mastectomy, right? Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for purposes of exams, right? And the thing is, there is this thing that you may see on the newer MBM exams that may shake you a little bit, and that's this thing called the GAIL, G-A-I-L, the GAIL risk model, right? The GAIL risk model. It's basically, again, you don't need to memorize the things that kind of factor into it, but you need to memorize a number. The number you need to memorize is 1.7%, right? Greater than or equal to 1.7%. Basically, if according to the GAIL risk model, your breast cancer risk over the next 5 years is like greater than or equal to 1.7%, the thing you're supposed to do on an NBM exam is to go ahead and you can put these people on anti-estrogen therapy, right? So what in the world do I mean by anti-estrogen therapy? Well, I mean a SERM, especially if you're premenopausal, right? If you're premenopausal, you're going to go ahead and put these people on a SERM, right? So what are those SERMs? Remember, the classic ones, there's tamoxifen, right? And there's raloxifen, right? There's tamoxifen and there's raloxifen. Essentially, these drugs, right, like tamoxifen, for example, is an estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast. So it's good, right? Because estrogen drives many breast cancers. Tamoxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast. But remember, it's an agonist in the bone and in the uterus, right? So because it's an estrogen agonist in the bone, it's actually going to lower a woman's risk for osteoporosis, right? But because it's an estrogen receptor agonist in the uterus, right, it's potentially going to cause endometrial hyperplasia, endometrial cancer, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for endometrial cancer is having exposure to unopposed estrogen, right? So this is why, for the most part, people that are on tamoxifen, once they hit 50, you're going to go ahead and shut that stuff down, right? And for the most part, people that are placed on tamoxifen on NBM exams, you try to limit it to no more than 5 years, right? You give women a 5-year course of tamoxifen. Remember, there is another agent that's a SERM called raloxifen. It's sort of kind of similar to tamoxifen, but the big difference is it is not an estrogen receptor agonist in the uterus. So because it is not an estrogen receptor agonist in the uterus, it does not increase endometrial cancer risk. The only problem, though, with raloxifen is that it is not as effective as tamoxifen. So if you are trying to do breast cancer chemoprophylaxis in a premenopausal woman on NBM exams, go with tamoxifen, not raloxifen, right? And remember that tamoxifen, in addition to that endometrial cancer risk, you know, it also increases risk of like postmenopausal symptoms like hot flashes, right? But it also increases the woman's risk of venous thromboembolic disease, right? It actually also increases a woman's risk of venous thromboembolic disease. These are, again, all reasons that factor into us saying, you know what, when a person is more than 50 years old, cut out the tamoxifen business for breast cancer chemoprophylaxis, right? So you may be like, okay, Divine, what do we use in women that are more than 50 years old, and women that are postmenopausal? Well, what you do is use an aromatase inhibitor, right? Use an aromatase inhibitor. So what in the world are these aromatase inhibitors? Well, these are drugs like anastrozole, right? Anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, right? Exemestane is E-X-E-M-E-S-T-A-N-E, right? Anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, right? So these drugs inhibit aromatase, because remember, if you're postmenopausal, the primary source of estrogen in you is essentially your fat cells, right? Because remember, fat cells express huge amounts of aromatase. So if you give an aromatase inhibitor, you will convert less androgen to estrogen, right? So the woman will have a reduced risk of breast cancer, right? And one subtle point that is floridly high yield to know is, like those SERMs, right? You know, you're going to get hot flashes, right? You're going to get hot flashes because you're essentially creating an estrogen deficiency. But one relatively high yield thing to know is that anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, those aromatase inhibitors, they actually do not increase your risk of venous thromboembolic disease. I'll say that again. They do not increase your risk of venous thromboembolic disease or endometrial cancer. It's a subtle difference, but it's a very high yield difference compared with tamoxifen, because again, they are creating an estrogen deficiency state. You literally will have like essentially like no estrogen around, right? So you're not going to have anything that's going to be increasing your risk of venous thromboembolic disease or driving your endometrial lining to cause endometrial cancer, right? So again, very high yield to keep this stuff at the back of your mind for exams, right? And again, I think I've kind of talked about the screening, right? So again, you know, breast cancer, what are some things you may see with breast cancer on an exam? You know, they may give you a clinical vignette. They may say, oh, the person feels a lump in their breast, right? Or the person has like some weird nipple discharge. Or they can tell you that, oh, the person has like nipple retraction or like skin dimpling, right? Or, you know, if a person's breast has like an orange peel appearance, right? The pod orange appearance, we're probably thinking more along the lines of inflammatory breast cancer. And one thing your friends at the NBME are pretty smart with inflammatory breast cancer is typically one thing they love to do is, they will tell you that, oh, they will put like mastitis as one of the answers, and then they can put like eczema as one of the answers, right? Don't fall for that stuff, right? So if you see that pod orange appearance, very high fevers, kind of looks like an infection, but they'll tell you that, oh, the woman has had this stuff for weeks, right? Again, the timeline is very helpful. They've had it for weeks. If you see that, think about inflammatory breast cancer, right? So think about inflammatory breast cancer. So the thing is, you know, if a person has breast cancer, and again, it's ERPR positive, again, you can use those agents that I've talked about, right? Those either like, again, if the woman is premenopausal, you use tamoxifen. If the woman is postmenopausal, you can use an aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole, letrozole, or exemestane, right? But remember, another classic receptor that these breast malignancies are can express is this HER2 receptor, right? The HER2 receptor. So remember, the HER2 receptor is a membrane-bound receptor, right? And it actually has, you know, a lot of tyrosine kinase activity, right? In fact, sometimes, instead of putting HER2 receptor as an answer choice, to mess with your head, they will put epidermal growth factor receptor, right? Epidermal growth factor receptor. So if a person has breast cancer that expresses HER2, that's actually like a bad prognostic indicator. However, right? It's the target of a drug known as trastuzumab, right? Remember, trastuzumab is a monoclonal antibody against the HER2 receptor that is very good in treating breast cancers that have that HER2 receptor positivity, right? So just something to keep in mind, right? For purposes of MBM exams, right? And I guess maybe another thing I should say is, whenever they give you a question about, because breast cancer, you know, you don't just only treat it with SERMs or aromatase inhibitors. You can also classically use these agents, right? Like drugs like your anthracyclines, right? Like doxorubicin, donorubicin. Remember, those drugs can cause dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So sometimes they can give you an MBME question and say, oh, a patient is about to be started on doxo or donorubicin or something like that. And then they'll say, prior to resuming beginning therapy, what's the next best step in management? And typically on an MBME exam, you want to pick some kind of echocardiogram, right? Because you just want to check and see what's the ejection fraction like. Because if the ejection fraction starts plummeting, you know what's the cause, right? And you're going to obviously go ahead and stop the drug. So remember that your anthracyclines like doxo and donorubicin, they tend to cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy, right? Because they upregulate the Fenton reaction, right? So you have all these free radical damage and of the cardiac myocytes, right? And then the person gets in trouble. And you'd be like, Divine, why is it the heart that these things go after? Well, think about it. The heart is one of the tissues in the body that uses like the biggest amount of oxygen, right? And remember, oxygen can be converted to many kinds of free radicals, right? So that's how people can get in trouble with this stuff. And again, remember, you can prevent it with dextroxin. Dextroxin is an iron chelator, right? That is essentially a Fenton reaction inhibitor, right? So that you don't develop that dilated cardiomyopathy that's associated with using anthracyclines like doxo and donorubicin, right? So remember, doxo, donorubicin, they cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. Contrast this with trastuzumab that causes a reversible. So when you stop the drug, the dilated cardiomyopathy will reverse. It causes a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy, right? And then for purposes of those that are taking the USMLE exams, remember, one immunologic mechanism your friends at the MBME kind of want you to know about as how trastuzumab helps with treating HER2 positive breast cancers is that it uses this thing called antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, ADCC, right? As one of its killing mechanisms, right? So basically, as a monoclonal, it binds to the antigen, right? And then probably like CD16, you know, like the gamma receptor of that you find on some immune system cells like NK cells, can then bind to the constant region of trastuzumab and then go ahead and that is essentially destroy the antigen it has bound to, which is a HER2 positive breast cancer cell, right? So that's just something to kind of keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So what are some other things that, I guess, classic scenarios that may pop up on a test that you want to keep at the back of your mind? Well, the first one is, what's the most common metastatic location for breast cancer, right? It's going to be the axillary lymph nodes, right? Remember, axillary lymph nodes are where breast cancers love to metastasize to, right? And remember, breast cancers, they can metastasize to bone and cause hypercalcemia of malignancy, right? They love to metastasize to bone and they can cause both lytic and blastic lesions, right? But typically on MBM exams, they're going to go after the blastic lesions, right? The thing is, whenever a person has breast cancer, like metastasis to bone, one classic MBME question is, they can say, oh, which of the following can be done to reduce the person's risk of pathologic fractures or to reduce the person's bone pain? One thing you can classically do on an MBM exam is to go ahead and perform radiation on that person's bone, right? Radiation therapy usually helps, right? But again, if you don't see that as an answer, one thing you can also consider is giving bisphosphonates, right? You can consider giving bisphosphonates on MBME exams. Remember, bisphosphonates are classically associated on MBMEs with jaw osteonecrosis, right? So if you see a person having trouble with chewing after they were recently started on therapy for like hypercalcemia of malignancy with breast cancer, I want you to think about jaw osteonecrosis with bisphosphonates, right? Jaw osteonecrosis with bisphosphonates, right? So how do we evaluate breast lesions, right? Typically, again, if you're less than 30 on an MBME exam, you're just going to go ahead and get an ultrasound, right? Although if you don't see ultrasound as an answer, if you're less than 30, one thing they can do is they can tell the woman to return if she still sees the symptoms after like one or two menstrual cycles. That's an alternate answer you may see on an MBME exam. But typically, for the most part, if you see a breast lesion in a person under 30, just get an ultrasound, right? Just get an ultrasound. If it's a solid mass, typically, if you notice a solid mass, you're going to do a mammogram after that. And with that mammogram, you're going to do a cornido biopsy because you want to get some kind of tissue diagnosis, right? But if you notice that it's a cystic mass, you can do like a fine needle aspiration, right? And if you see like blood from that fine needle aspirate, right? If you see blood or something like that, you're going to send it off for cytology, right? Just to make sure that you're not seeing malignant cells. So let me repeat this again. If you notice that you do a woman under 30, right? You want to do an ultrasound first, right? If you see a mass, if you see a solid mass, go ahead and refer the person for a mammogram and a cornido biopsy, right? Mammogram and a cornido biopsy. But if you see a cystic mass, do a fine needle aspiration, right? You do the fine needle aspiration, you'll find if you see like blood, right, or whatever, you're gonna go ahead and send it off for cytology to look for malignant cells, right? So that's something that's kind of high to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Now, one bizarre scenario you may see on an OB-GYN shelf exam is they may say, "Oh, you know what? A woman under 30 palpated a breast mass, and we did an ultrasound, we didn't find the breast mass." And then they'll say, "What is your next best step in diagnosis? Do you know what it is? It's to get a mammogram, right? If you don't see a breast mass on ultrasound in a woman that is under the age of 30." Your next best step on an MBM exam will be to go ahead and get a mammogram. Okay, that's very high yield to know. But again, for any woman over the age of 30 and she has a palpable breast mass, just go ahead and perform a mammogram. Right, go ahead and perform a mammogram. That's your next best step in diagnosis. Right. And then I think some other things that may help, right, with some of these, I guess, breast things. Remember, if a person has unilateral bloody nipple discharge, again, don't forget, never get this wrong on an exam, right? That's pretty much almost certainly going to be like some kind of intraductal papilloma, right? It's going to be some kind of intraductal papilloma. And then what if they tell you that you have a woman that is postmenopausal, right? And she has like a greenish breast discharge, right? So she's postmenopausal and she has a greenish breast discharge. If you see stuff like that, I want you to definitely, and you know, sometimes they may even tell you that, oh, when you biopsy the mass, you found like some kind of lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate. That's like their buzzword. If you see stuff like that, I want you to absolutely think about something called mammary duct ectasia, right? Think about mammary duct ectasia. That's actually something your friends at the MBME love to test quite a bit, right? So think about mammary duct ectasia in those circumstances. And then one other thing that your friends at the MBME love to test is, oh, what is the most important prognostic factor in a person that has breast cancer? Well, it's obviously going to be like axillary lymph node involvement, right? It's either going to be, you know, like axillary lymph node involvement or like metastasis, right? If you've already seen mets, right, then that's going to be the biggest prognostic factor in that patient on an MBME exam, right? It's going to be the biggest prognostic factor in that patient on an MBME exam. And then, remember, they can also ask you a question. I'm just throwing out random scenarios at this point. They can ask, oh, what is the biggest risk factor for a breast abscess, right? What is the biggest risk factor for mastitis or breast abscess? I would really hope that you're telling me that, essentially being a lactating mother is like the biggest risk factor, right? Being a lactating mother is the biggest risk factor on an MBM exam, right? And again, don't forget your fibrocystic breast disease. I've talked about this in many podcasts, right? You'll see like a lot of nodularity in the breast, like lumpy, bumpy breast kind of deal, right? And usually the lesions get more painful as the person is about to hit up their menses, right? And then if they tell you, oh, this person has like a mobile, well-circumscribed, like discrete breast mass, right? You want to think about a fibroadenoma, right? Or what if they tell you that, oh, you see a question about a person and, you know, she was attacked by some bandits or something and she was punched in the chest, right? Or the person may have just had like a breast biopsy or breast surgery. And then the person has like persistent pain in a part of the breast and you see like a fluid collection. If you see that, I really want you to think about a breast hematoma, right? I really want you to think about a breast hematoma on an MBM exam, right? Think about a breast hematoma on an MBM exam, right? And again, one thing I just want to say about breast cancer, right? Like, especially if a person has like DCIS, right? Like ductal carcinoma in situ, there's really no big difference between doing like breast conservation therapy, right? So what do I mean by breast conservation therapy? I just mean like doing like lumpectomy plus radiation versus doing like a mastectomy, right? There's basically no difference in survival, but there's an increased risk of local recurrence when you do that breast conserving therapy where you do a lumpectomy with a radiation, right? Just something to keep at the back of your mind for for exams, right? And again, remember, if you're doing a lymph node dissection, you want to do a sentinel lymph node dissection first, right? I mean, sentinel lymph node biopsy first, because you want to, you know, try to reduce the risk of lymphedema for the woman, right? You want to kind of try to reduce that risk. So you're going to do a sentinel lymph node biopsy first. But if it's positive, unfortunately, you then need to do that axillary lymph node dissection. And sadly, that axillary lymph node dissection, again, can increase the risk of chronic lymphedema of the arm. And that those things can actually turn malignant and become like a lymphangiosarcoma, right? Which is unfortunate. And again, definitely happens sometimes. At least it's something that your friends at the MBME love to test. And again, like I've said, if a person has metastatic breast cancer, you know, you're going to put them on tamoxifen if they're on an MBME test, right? You're going to put, because chemotherapy is what you usually will do if a person has metastatic disease of any sort, right? So if a person has metastatic breast cancer of any sort, just go ahead and put them on tamoxifen, right? But again, if they have bone involvement, right, like hypercalcemia or malignancy, the thing you want to do on a test is, again, radiation can help, right? But you can also put those people on bisphosphonates. And again, don't forget the osteonecrosis of the jaw, right? With bisphosphonates, right? Don't forget the osteonecrosis of the jaw with bisphosphonates, right? Don't forget the osteonecrosis of the jaw with bisphosphonates. And again, one thing that I guess I will say, right? If a woman gets like radiation therapy to her breast and then she starts having like this neck mass a few years later, I would hope you're thinking about papillary thyroid cancer, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for papillary thyroid cancer is prior exposure to neck radiation. Or they may tell you that, oh, the person is having like shortness of breath, chest pain, and all those things, right? The person actually probably has like radiation associated like pericarditis, right? So again, people can get cardiac issues after getting like radiation therapy to the chest on MBME exams. So since I'm running for an engagement, I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. But again, if you listen to this podcast and you know everything I've discussed here, you're pretty much set from a breast cancer perspective for purposes of your exam. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, 30-day shelf exams. And I also do it, you know, I also help people with like ERAS applications for residency, especially if you have like all these red flags or you have like an especially tricky application. So please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, right? Whenever I make a new podcast, you get an email notification. And I also typically, you know, you can find these podcasts on like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. So, you know, subscribe to those. And again, any little bit of support definitely helps. And then if you want my videos, go on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcast and Videos. If you subscribe to that, you'll be able to see the videos that I have made. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.